Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of Yeshiva University Center for the Jewish Future and REITs Rabbinic Alumni, I would like to welcome you to this very important webcast. The Center for the Jewish Future's mission statement is to shape, enrich, and inspire the contemporary Jewish community by convening the resources of Yeshiva University to infuse the student body with the spirit of leadership and a sense of Klal Yisrael, to build, to cultivate, and support communities, rabbinic and lay leaders, and individuals, and to create a global movement that promotes the values of Yeshiva University. REITs Rabbinic Alumni serves as the vehicle by which former Talmidim of REITs, such as myself and Rabbi Golden, can continue experiencing the spirit, the air of enthusiasm, and the excitement which filled their formative student years. Social contacts with their chaverim and the yeshiva are maintained, ongoing developments at REITs are reported, and divrei Torah of the highest quality are all shared in all sorts of wonderful different venues. Opportunities to revisit the yeshiva take place regularly through Yemei Iyun on timely issues and events, which brings together as many as three generations of students who interact with each other. REITs Rabbinic Alumni is coordinated by CJF and REITs. Joining us on this webcast are rabbis from different denominations, from our Chaverim at the Rabbinical Council of America, from Chabad Shluchim, calling in from all points of the United States, Canada, and Israel. We also have a reporter listening in. For those of you on the phone, please mute your phones. If anyone would like to ask a question at any time during the broadcast, please email Rabbinic Alumni, one word, RABBINICALUMNI at yu.edu with the word webcast in the subject line. Those emails will be delivered directly to me. I can't guarantee that we will present each and every question asked, but I certainly will give it my best try. Last week at this time, the CJF engaged in a fascinating discussion addressing the financial and legal aspects of the financial crisis and hearing from two colleagues who are engaged in financially helping members of their respective communities. Today's panel focuses more on the emotional side. We'll hear from Dr. Barris and Dr. Pelkowitz on the mental health issues and from Rabbi Golden, who will address things from the hashkafic side. I am Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Schwartz, and I've been selected to be the moderator simply because I believe I am the bridge, as I am the rabbi of Congregation Hadassah Yisrael of Elizabeth, New Jersey, and I am also a psychologist in private practice at the Center for Cognitive Behavioral Psychotherapy here in Manhattan. Our work at the center focuses very much on the issues surrounding the different aspects of anxiety, and I thought it would be helpful this morning, before we introduce our speakers, if as a rabbi who joins you in the field, I could give you a sense of some of the symptoms that mental health professionals look for when they're assessing people, and perhaps we as rabbis might notice in the work that we find ourselves doing. When we deal with issues of anxiety, very often, certainly situational stress and situational anxiety that would be perhaps of concern to us as rabbis and perhaps as neighbors and friends, we tend to look for senses of wound up, tense feelings within our congregants, restlessness, perhaps a sense of being easily fatigued or worn out, concentration problems, new irritability, significant tension in muscles, difficulty with sleep or with appetite, changes in sleep and appetite, all of which might suggest one form of an anxiety disorder. Difficulty in controlling anxiety and worry might be yet another symptom worthy of perhaps paying attention to and perhaps encouraging the use and the benefit of some of our helping systems, including some of our best in terms of mental health. Often people go through experiences that are more similar to a post-traumatic stress disorder. We're blessed this morning with the presence of Dr. Pelkowitz, who helped actually write the diagnosis. He was very much involved in the diagnostic criteria. The Boulder model, which was used in terms of establishing clinical post-traumatic stress disorder, and whether one meets the necessary criteria for that particular diagnosis, does not guarantee that one who doesn't meet it is not suffering from post-traumatic stress. The psychological model, which certainly reflects on different aspects of trauma, certainly our current financial crisis and people's personal dealings with them would fall within the psychological model. Intrusive recollections, recurrent dreams, senses of distress, internal cues, reliving or numbing to that event, feelings of detachment or estrangement from others would all seem to give a certain sense of concern that we, perhaps as rabbis, might become very much attuned to and might therefore find an opportunity or perhaps be called upon within such a situation to intervene. Again, reported thoughts of difficulty falling or perhaps difficulty staying asleep, irritability, difficulty concentrating, hypervigilance, these would all be different issues that might come up and suggest a certain degree of a post-traumatic stress. At the same time, we would be amiss if we didn't note the stages of depression and the potential presence of a major depressive episode. Depressed mood, observations made by others, perhaps fellow congregants or the rabbis themselves, of the fact that, quite frankly, people who are suffering, a particular congregant or friend, neighbor, who happens to be depressed most of the day, nearly every day, marked diminished interest or pleasure in almost all or all activities made every day, significant weight loss when a person's not involved as a result of a diet, which, quite honestly, if I would engage in, would make things a little bit better. Perhaps a weight gain, and a significant weight gain. Sleep changes and sleep patterns, insomnia or hypersomnia, an inability to fall asleep, or a sense of always being asleep, a fatigue or a loss of energy more or less every day. And the big three, feelings and reportings of helplessness, hopelessness, and worthlessness, all tend to be involved in the symptomatology that we associate in the clinical world with a sense of a major depressive episode. Strung together, and perhaps adding into a mix suicidal ideation, would be a very good time for a rabbi or another helping professional to suggest seating to a greater expert in the fields of mental health. Our speakers this morning are here to provide us with a little bit of insight into what we can do as rabbis and what we can expect when working with mental health professionals. Our first speaker this morning, Dr. Sarah Barris, is going to address the issues that she has come across and perhaps some of the strategies she's currently using when dealing with adults facing today's financial crisis. Dr. Barris received her doctorate in clinical psychology from Yeshiva University, Firkhoff Division, in 1986. And since 1988, she's been highly active in the field of relationships, parenting, marriage, and infertility. Dr. Barris has written and lectured extensively around the psychological and emotional variables surrounding these issues and those surrounding the family in general. So Dr. Barris serves as the co-director of support services for the American Fertility Association. And in that capacity, she has created and developed their national telecoaching support groups. She is a part of Dr. Martin Seligman's team at the University of Pennsylvania, helping to facilitate the Penn Resilience Prevention Program. Dr. Barris has a full-time private practice in Forest Hills, New York. She's married and the mother of five children, and may I add, quite a wonderful source of advice. And it's therefore my distinct pleasure to welcome Dr. Sarah Barris.
Thank you. Hello, Doctor. It's really a privilege for me to present today at Yeshiva University. Now, there's an analyst, Fred Pine, famous psychoanalyst. He talked about the fact that when people come in for therapy, eventually you can sort of get them to talk about anything. Deep-seated issues, childhood issues, mother-in-law issues, sexuality, addictions. But when it comes to money, there's just a real heightened sensitivity and tremendous resistance. And, you know, that's because money really, really presents a very, very potent metaphor in our culture. So today we're talking about financial loss, we're talking about job loss, and for people who are experiencing that, for them it's a real, real assault on self-esteem, a loss of self-identity. There are tremendous feelings of shame, humiliation, shock, and as Rabbi Schachter said, trauma. there's also a loss of control and a loss of safety. And so, you know, people are encouraged, talk to your husband, talk to your wife. And that can be tremendously difficult too, because the family many times is in shock too. They're also numb and they're also going through a certain grief process. What we sometimes see is a sense of blame, whether it's self-blame, or blame of one spouse towards the other. You should have, you could have, you didn't. There's anger. So when the congregant is finally coming to their rabbi, they're really, really experiencing a sense of deep despair. And so there's a temptation. There's a real temptation to kind of find the silver lining for them, talk about positive thinking. The culture is very into positivity these days, and happiness, resilience. So positive thinking, gratitude. And I think that's all very powerful and very important, but everything's about the timing. And for many of these people, when they're talking, even to their own friends, when they feel safe enough opening up, their friends are telling them, you know, you should really be happy that your house didn't burn down, or that, you know, our neighbor lost everything. You should be happy that you don't have cancer. So-and-so's mother, they have breast cancer and they're dealing with job loss. So there is a feeling of just being very, very sort of ashamed and overwhelmed by the volume of their grief, feeling misunderstood and feeling that people can't really sit with their stuff, that it's being whitewashed, although the intention is always very, very positive. There's a sense that God has lost track of them. And so what we're really asking for this first step here is real generous listening and deep validation. And that's, it's sort of like a message that it's okay not to be okay initially. Now, we're not talking about a self-pitying or a wallowing in depression or encouraging that. We're just talking about skillful compassion, which is more about respect, dignity, tenderness, the courage it takes to show up for this and to take step by step and take one step at a time when facing this kind of trauma. So first step, deep listening, skillful compassion. Second, isolation. We want to help combat isolation. Community, friends can provide an incredible safety net for people going through this. They help provide hope. They help people break it down. They help people find meaning. And as I said initially, sometimes your closest family is not necessarily quite there because they're also suffering and struggling. So friends, community, connection is very important. Last week during the webcast, the idea of privacy versus support and networking, that is a paradox, and we want to be sensitive about balance and kind of shift from one to the other. Number three, routine. Helping, the routine has changed now, but we want to find a sense of daily routine, a sense of structure, even ritual, very important, whether it's going to daven, going to synagogue to pray, whether it is birthdays, anniversaries, we want to keep the rituals going. The rituals become dependable times that people can connect and find meaning. So encouraging the ritual is also important. Number four, cognitive behavioral intervention. Now, again, it's about timing. So there is a point in time where we can talk about realistic optimism. There are people out there who are just wired that way. Their DNA helps them along with that kind of thinking. It's sort of, they have the ability to attend to positive events in their lives. They have ability to cultivate positive thinking styles. So when people are struggling with thinking traps, when they're futurizing, catastrophizing, awfulizing, when they find that, they're just sort of projecting this incredible, exaggerated sense of doom, we want to be able to kind of help them challenge that kind of thinking style, and move towards more realistic possibilities, breaking it down and goal setting with one step at a time. Number five, there's the buzzword out there, mindfulness. It's been around for a long time, but it's very current. Mindfulness stress reduction. There are wonderful packets out there and techniques. One is Jon Kabat-Zinn, MBSR, the Mind-Body Stress Reduction technique. You can access that online. Harvard Medical School has a portable guide to stress. Mindfulness, you know, in a nutshell, is about staying present in your life with acceptance. Here is where the gratitude, the silver lining, here is where that can come in, again, with the right timing, all in right timing. Number six, mentoring. Mentoring and peer support is a very, very powerful tool. The studies have shown that when people can mentor and help others, they really feel better themselves. Many times you can see a solution to your friend's problem that you cannot really find for yourself. So don't shy away from helping people to help others. We used to think that it was really finding a mentor, but it's actually putting people in mentoring position that can really be a mutative element towards repair and recovery. Okay, when to refer to a professional. We want to keep an eye, of course, on suicidal ideation. That's very real and important. That's a real red flag. You want to keep an eye on, as we talked about earlier, hopelessness, persistent hopelessness. Initially, that hopelessness and helplessness and isolation, that's pretty normal. But when we see that it persists, when the isolation persists, those are red flags for professional referral. Sometimes when people go through vulnerability, their own vulnerability begins to creep up, like addiction behavior, gambling, substance abuse. These are all red flags for referral. And I do want to say that the research shows that overall, community support is really one of the most powerful mediating variables towards recovery and towards healing. And just watching that webcast last week, it was very, very inspiring to look at the community outreach that's already in place. Eliezer Project, Project Ezra, people, individuals coming out, professionals coming out to lend a hand. And, you know, it's inspiring, and I think it absolutely generates hope and a sense of real optimism in this hard time of crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Barris, for an absolutely wonderful opening presentation. And I remind you in the interim that those who are either viewing our webcast or those who are on the teleconference as well, if you have questions for Dr. Barris or for any of our presenters, please feel comfortable to email them directly to rabbinicalumni@yu.edu, rabbinicalumni, one word, and of course in the subject line, please mark the word webcast. Our second speaker is the Dean of Pastoral Psychology. Anyone in the Jewish mental health field knows Dr. David Pelkowitz. He holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration, where he is also the special assistant to the president. Having served over two decades as the director of psychology at North Shore University, NYU School of Medicine, and clinical professor of psychology and psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine, Dr. Pelkowitz has consulted extensively with the Jewish community in the United States, Europe, Israel, South America, on a whole wide range of issues facing children and adolescents. Dr. Pelkowitz received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics related to education, parenting, and child mental health. His areas of research and clinical specialty include family violence, the impact of domestic violence, stress management, transmitting values to children and adolescents, and coping with trauma and loss. He recently published Balanced Parenting, a book he wrote in collaboration with his father on parenting from a Jewish perspective, and I'm glad to report very soon we'll be publishing a study on the year of in Israel, available at the SOY Svarim sale, which will begin on February 1st. He will be conducting a personal signing on February the 5th as well. I thank Dr. Pelkowitz for giving his time this morning, as I know he's quite busy. He'll be leaving to Israel this evening. And I want to introduce Dr. David Pelkowitz, the wonderful inspiration to all of us in Jewish mental health, to focus on his lecture topic this morning, dealing with the children. Dr. Pelkowitz.
Thank you so much for that very warm introduction. What I wanted to focus on is based on a series of research studies that actually inform what we're all dealing with quite a bit. We are lucky that starting in the 1980s, a very respected research team followed a group of children who were living in areas where people lost their farms. Now, that may sound like it has very little to do with our world and our way of life, but what they did was is they looked at, over the next two decades, what were the sources of resilience and what were the sources of risk, and they had a wonderful comparison group. And what I wanted to talk about is based both on that and on three large-scale studies on resilience in children in the face of stress. And I'm going to organize my remarks around the five C's. The first C is one of the main findings in these studies, which I think you always have to hold on to as background music in your work, is the C of conflict. It turns out that having very little because of financial stress really was not very predictive of anything. Kids adapt very quickly to living in a world where there's less money to go around. In fact, the greatest risk for depression in adolescents is adolescents who come from wealthy environments. The highest rate of depression in what's referred to by many in the field as affluenza is in kids living in wealthy suburban neighborhoods are at about triple the risk for depression, anxiety, and alcohol and substance abuse. Having less money is actually really not predictive of risk at all. What is predictive of risk is the sea of conflict. When there's high levels of expressed emotion, of yelling, screaming, and criticism at home, either of parents who are stressed out taking it out on their kids, or even more importantly, parents beginning to fight each other, that's incredibly predictive. It turns out that in times of stress, building a protective shield around kids is probably the single most important thing to do. We know, for example, that even as basic a level as health, kids who grow up in homes where they're exposed to a lot of parental fighting are 6 to 8 times more likely to get sick in a given year. So take home message number one is to the extent that you're working with families in your shuls or in other settings, be very aware of when it starts to take a toll on shalom bias, because that's actually probably even more predictive than shifts in lifestyle in terms of impact on children and adolescents. C number two is a rather obvious C, but it comes out very clearly in the Conger studies, in the farm studies, as well as in the three large-scale resilience studies. And it's basically something that I've spoken about before in many venues. What boils down to is naming the monster, communication. I have a friend who took a PET scan of a colleague of his who was caught in the World Trade Center on 9/11. And when he showed me the slide showing this man's brain as he was reliving the horror of that day, what was incredibly striking was that Broca's area was shut down, meaning the language centers of the brain were shut down. When I saw the slide, my first thought was, this is Vayidom Aharon. This is silence. It's total silence in the face of horrible trauma. And then what he showed is that the refuah came from lighting up Broca's area. It came from giving words. There was an incredible study that's very topical given what's happening in Eretz Yisrael these weeks, where they looked at what predicted resilience in children who lost their fathers in the Yom Kippur War. It turned out the number one predictor was lighting up Broca's area. It was going from demimus to words, being able to talk about it. When these kids grew up in homes where it was okay to talk about their sadness about their lost fathers, and where their mothers were able to talk about their grief, even if they remarried, and where pictures of the father were still around the house, that was the single most potent predictor of resilience in these kids as they went into adulthood. And I think that we have to hold on to that, because very often I think rabbis play that crucial role in terms of being the one who takes people into a place where you give them words, either by something as basic as a drasha that validates and talks about the stress, or reaching out to them and putting your arm around them and asking them how they're doing, and encouraging the open communication about what's going on. So that's the second C. So it's the C of conflict, the C of communication. Then the third C is what Dr. Barris spoke about so beautifully, is the C of connection. In these studies, they found that a key predictor, be it in studies on the island of Kauai or Martha's Vineyard or the Isle of Wight, where they followed economically distressed kids who were abused or victims of crime, or in the farm studies where it was all about economic hardship, it turned out that a key predictor was connection, in that case, to church, school, and civic organizations. So to the extent that a rabbi could pull congregants in, and even kids in, to connection, that's incredibly, incredibly important. There's a idea of required helpfulness. Very often, when we ask kids to pitch in, especially in tough times, we ask them without overburdening them to help out. It's actually probably one of the single most powerful antidotes to the helplessness that takes place when people are overwhelmed by things that are out of control. And that's the fourth C. It's the C of lack of control. Over and over again, the research shows that any way that you could extract feelings of control in places where there's not so much control, it makes an enormous difference. I'm often reminded of the beautiful Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch on Kanesher Yair Kinel Al Gozolov Yerachet. He asks, why is it that Bnei Yisrael in times of Tzara are compared to an eagle? And he answers, because all other animals, when their babies are in danger, the babies are in a passive position as the mother bird, for example, swoops down on the nest and carries the baby to safety. Because eagles fly higher than any other animal, what happens is the mother eagle hovers around the nest and the baby eagle has to jump on her back as she flies to safety, because that's the safest place for the baby eagle, Rav Hirsch points out. And the take-home message there is that we're compared to eagles because eagles take an active role. And that sea of control is key. In the studies on resilience in the face of economic hardship, any way you could extract control, be it even in terms of giving kids ways of helping out, earning extra money when they didn't have to earn money before, not to support the family, although interestingly, after the Depression of 1929, the people who had to quit school and work to help out their younger siblings were actually more resilient than the younger siblings who had more education. So going from passive to active is key. One of my favorite studies on this was the study done where they were trying to understand why some kids were symptomatic and had post-traumatic stress disorder after a school shooting in Los Angeles and others weren't. So they were interviewing 2 9-year-olds who were right next to each other during the shooting. One kid had full-blown PTSD, the other kid was fine. So they interviewed the kid who had no post-traumatic symptoms, and they asked him, why was it that you're doing so fine? And he said, look, he said, I really felt prepared for this shooting. He said, the week before, I had an earthquake preparation course. This was in Los Angeles. And he said, if there's ever an earthquake, dive for cover. And when the shooting started, I said to myself, this is like an earthquake. So I knew exactly what to do. It's actually those kind of findings that are being used now in Eretz Yisrael, especially in Sderot, where they're actually doing resilience building by giving kids as much control as possible in a situation where they often have no control. And that's the key ingredient of resilience. And the final ingredient is the ingredient of coping style, is that you can't get married to just one kind of coping style. Some kids cope by talking, other kids cope best by distracting, other kids cope best through music, other kids cope best through being able to write. And what the research shows is to the extent that we're sensitive to children's and adults' coping styles, they're going to do much better. And our job, in essence, is to help them build up a good toolbox of coping mechanisms as a way of bringing them out. I'm going to end with a story. Can I end with a story? We have time for a story? Good. I'm at the 8-minute mark. Okay. A little bit of a long story, but I'm emboldened to say it by something that Dr. Barris was saying about the importance of mindfulness. So this has been my favorite mindfulness story lately. And it's a story about a colleague of yours who was a brilliant pastoral psychologist who passed away about a year and a half ago. And I happened to be at the Shiva. And I'm sitting at the Shiva, and in walks, as I'm being Menachem Avil, in walks a non-Jewish doctor, very prominent cardiovascular surgeon. And people are clearly recognizing him. He's evidently the leading cardiovascular surgeon in the New York area, maybe even in the country. And he tells the following story. He said, "I never paid a condolence story call before, but I felt I owed this to your father because I felt he saved me." He tells the children sitting Shiva. And he tells the following unbelievable story that I'll end with. He says that he one day gets a phone call that his younger 40-year-old brother had a massive MI, a massive heart attack, and suddenly died. And he went into a state of yish, a state of severe depression, because he said, "Eskarma chalona tata, here I am, you know, saving the lives of people from all over the world, people in their 80s, people in their 90s, and my own brother, I couldn't even help." And he becomes more and more depressed and he retires, which of course isn't the answer. He hands in his resignation, and of course he becomes even more depressed because it made him even more disconnected and more pulled into the quicksand of his depression. Then he remembers that he had done bypass surgery on this rabbi who he remembers was a very holy man. And he looks through his records, he contacts the rabbi. And he goes to, this is the man who the children were sitting Shiva for, and he goes and he visits the rabbi and he tells the following story. He says, "The rabbi tells me that every human being has a soul, and there's a spark that's unique for every single soul. And your job in life is to find what's your unique spark. What is it that lights you up? What is it that is your divine purpose that'll put your soul on fire?" And the rabbi, he said, wouldn't give me the answer about what my divine spark was, but he said he'd meet with me and we'd read and talk together. And together we had some guided readings. And as I was reading, he said, in one meeting with him, I felt, the doctor said, that I came to the answer for me. It was a Tolstoy short story. And the short story was called The Three Questions. And the end of the short story was that whenever you have somebody in front of you, you have to ask three questions. Question number one is, what's the most important time? The answer is, "In lo'af shavei masai." If not now, when? The most important time is now. Question number two is, what's the most important thing? The most important thing is to do chesed, is to do good. Olam chesed yibane. And question number three is, when you have somebody in front of you, you have to ask yourself, who's the most important person? And the answer is, the most important person is the person in front of you. Somehow, these three questions connected for this doctor in a way that he started to feel himself coming out of the depths of his depression. Now, he's back to doing surgery, but with one change. Before every bypass, if you want to operate in his operating room, you have to do the following. You have to hold hands. They form a circle around the patient. The anesthesiologist, the nurses, the x-ray techs, the whole team. And he calls out the questions. First question is, what's the most important time? Everybody, they want to operate in that room, they have to call out. Now! Then he calls out. What's the most important thing? They have to answer. Most important thing is to do good. And then he asks, who's the most important person? The person in front of us. Let's operate. And that's the bottom line in terms of mindfulness. I think that what the real answer for this is keeping in mind the five C's, the C of being aware of the impact of conflict and the impact of having a protective shield as the antidote to that. The impact of communication and lighting up Broca's area and going from demimus to being able to talk about what's on your mind. The C of connection, which often you're the source of. The C of control and the C of paying attention to individual coping styles, that as we are mindful of everybody going through tough times and we try to remember when they're in front of us to ask those three questions, I hope we're all Zocha to be able to help people in times of darkness to help light up their neshamas. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. Pelkowitz. Again, I remind those on the teleconference as well as those on the line and on the webcast that the questions that will be available following our third opening statement can be sent directly to us at rabbinicalumni@yu.edu. That's one word, rabbinicalumni@yu.edu, with the subject line webcast. And those questions will be gathered and will be sent into the panel to give them the opportunity to address them. Our panel of experts has certainly been blessed with the opening presentations of Drs. Barris and Pelkowitz. And we turn now to a presentation from a true rabbi's rabbi. Rabbi Shmuel Golden has served as the spiritual leader of Congregation Ahavas Torah in Englewood, New Jersey since 1984. With a membership of over 700 families, Ahavas Torah is the largest Orthodox synagogue in northern New Jersey. As though having 700 congregants is not enough, Rabbi Golden is also an instructor of Bible and philosophy at the IBC, the Isaac Brewer College, and the James Stryer School of Yeshiva University. He is also the founding director and lecturer at the Eve Fleckner Torah Institute, which is an institute of Torah study located in Bergen County and in the Bergen County community. He has served on the faculty of numerous other institutes. Rabbi Golden is past president of Rabbinic Alumni of Yeshiva University, past president of the RCBC, the Rabbinical Council of Bergen County, and former chairman of his Kashrus Committee. He's a member of other various prominent Jewish organizations, and is the founder and chairman of Shvil HaZahav. It goes without saying that Rabbi Golden has therefore been recognized with a number of awards, but I speak, I think, clearest at noting that Rabbi Golden's greatest award is the appreciation that comes when he realizes that he can get through to his students. Not only his students and his congregants, but his students here at Yeshiva, his students who are rabbis in the field themselves, those who know him up front, those who have had a chance to enjoy his benefits, either directly through conversation, which I can honestly attest to on a personal level on a number of occasions. I was his son's counselor in camp once upon a time. And those who have now had the opportunity to benefit from reading from his special perspective on Torah and on current events. Rabbi Golden has recently released the second volume of Unlocking the Torah Text, Shmot, which has been released recently in December 2008 and is a Geffen Publishing House publication. It, too, will hopefully be on sale and still in stock when you make it to the Svarim sale, which begins at the SOI Svarim sale, which begins on February the 1st. Rabbi Golden has authored several articles on the peace process, Israel-Diaspora relations, interdenominational dialogue, and a bunch of other current issues. Rabbi Golden is a rabbi's rabbi and a very much a current individual. It's a distinct pleasure to ask him to offer us a Jewish philosophical outlook on affluence and the role of money in our lives, and a distinct pleasure to introduce Rabbi Shmuel Golden.
Wow, thank you very much for that beautiful introduction, Rabbi Shmuel. Thank you. If it's not in stock, then we'll make sure it's in stock for the Svarim Sale. It's an honor and a pleasure to participate on this panel with my fellow panelists and with our moderator, who also really has been a panelist. The insights that they gave concerning what I consider to be our most important role during these critical times, the pastoral responsibilities that we have on an individual level to our congregants, those insights have truly been, for me, very educational and very, very, very wonderful. I'd like to take the discussion in a bit of a different direction by looking at the way in which the pulpit can be used as an extension of our pastoral reach during these difficult times. There is no question that the greatest good can be accomplished on a person-to-person basis, on an individual basis, but from the pulpit as well, much can be done and much must be done if we are to really meet these critical times. And I believe that there are two global areas that have to be addressed or that should be addressed as we consider our congregants and the ways in which they are reacting to the times before them. The first is really the global area that has been addressed in the panel, and that is the issue of the loss of affluence. The ways in which our congregants are dealing with issues that are for them wrenching and difficult. From the pulpit, it seems to be that there must be a sense of recognition and validation, the very kind of validation that was spoken of before, that we can speak of the fact that we are aware of these issues, that they are real, that we're not glossing over them, that we consider them to be real issues of great concern. From the pulpit, there can be a realistic sense of reassurance that there are important things in life that remain solid, that remain real. From the pulpit, there should be a sense of perspective without being false, a sense of perspective that says that this is very important, what you're going through is extremely important, and yet at the same time, there are so many other pieces of our lives that remain whole, that remain real, and we have to see them. And from the pulpit, there has to be, it seems to me, a sense of togetherness and a recognition that as a community, we need to pull together. And each shul and each community, each synagogue, has to do that in its own way in determining how the community will work together. And speaking on Shabbat morning serves as a way of setting that communal agenda, of announcing the community programs, of speaking of their importance, and the ways in which we can deal with each other. It should be noted that in this area of, in this first global area, this area of a loss of affluence, I almost hesitate to speak about it, but I've sensed it a bit, and I think it's something that has to be noted as well, and that is that there's a delicate balance that becomes somewhat overturned between the congregant and the rabbi during times like this. Many congregants always feel that they are the secure ones, and the rabbi, well, he's sort of an employee. All of a sudden now, the rabbi has a secure job, at least hopefully in most of our congregations, and the congregants are the ones who are struggling a bit. And certain comments that I've personally heard on Shabbat morning have illustrated this. Someone will say to me at the Kiddush periodically, not the same person, different people, sometimes the same person, Rabbi, you're getting a paycheck. You're lucky. You're getting a paycheck every day, whether it's every week, every day. You're getting a paycheck every week, every month. You know, the rest of us, we're not in such secure positions. And there's a sense there that there's a little bit more under the surface than simply a joke that Shabbat morning. And I think we need to recognize it. I think we need to realize it. And I think we need to somehow be aware that there's a discomfort that sometimes exists when the Rav is perceived to be more secure than those within the congregation. How we deal with that, I'll leave for the psychiatrists to tell us, perhaps. The second global area that I think has to be addressed from the pulpit, and this is an area that if you've been watching the web, the emails which you've received, numerous rabbis are moving into, and I think we need to move into this area without question as leaders within the community, but at the same time it has to be done with a great deal of calibration and caution. And that is, this difficult time provides us as rabbonim with the opportunity to back up for a minute and to perhaps reset the priorities within our communities and within our congregations concerning the whole issue of affluence. this is an opportunity for us to turn to our communities and to say, wait a minute, how have we been defining ourselves? What is it that we have considered to be the most important aspects of our lives? How much time have we spent in our businesses as compared with our homes? What is the way in which we define ourselves as people? If the way in which we've defined ourselves as people has been from an affluent, from a perspective of affluence, has been from a perspective of wealth, has been from a perspective of success in the job market, and that's been our primary definition, then no wonder we're hurting. And should we redefine ourselves? Should we redefine the way we view others and the way in which we've held others in respect only because of their affluence? Or should we be looking at other people and defining people within the Jewish community from the perspective of who they are rather than what they earn? It's an opportunity for us to take a look as on issues that we all hold dear and that I'm sure many of us have spoken about, and that is the question of smachot, the question of how we spend our money within the Jewish community, and whether there should be a recalibration for us to live in communities. And I know this from my personal experience, and I'm sure many of you have had similar experiences, where people take out loans in order to have a simcha that they cannot afford, particularly because they'll say, Rabbi, our child, we don't want our child to be left out. Our child has to have what everybody else is having. Well, is this a time for us to reconsider what everyone is having and whether or not this is the time to recalibrate our concern, the money that we're spending on these smachot, having lost what the major purpose of a bar or bat mitzvah might be? I know that I shot my major salvo in this battle on the holiday of Hanukkah, where when I turned to the issue of Hidur mitzvah, and I spoke about the fact that the mitzvah, the Hanukkah Neirot, is a Mahadrin mitzvah, perhaps because we fought against the Hidur that was Greece, and to be Mahader our own is the best defense. And perhaps what it means is we have to look about whether or not we've accepted external values as the definition of what we consider to be success and whether we should recalibrate that. If I were to speak of in these next few weeks about this, perhaps, and I'm throwing out a tidbit for the Rabbanim and the pulpit to consider, maybe the balance between the importance of value and worth on a practical level and not letting that value and worth rule us can be seen when HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to Moshe on the very eve of Yetzias Mitzrayim and says, Moshe, tell the people, V'yishalu ish me'es re'eu, v'yishal me'es re'usa, play kesef, play zahav. Tell them to gain this affluence. Tell them to gain this material. And it's clear that within Judaism, material has a place. And yet in the final analysis, that material is judged not by its own benefit, but by how we use it and how we rule over it. And that very material was, of course, used, lahavdil, for the Egel, and conversely for the creation of the Mishkan. So the lesson being that there is a place for affluence, there is a place for wealth in our community, but it doesn't rule us. We control it, and we allow it to become an important part of our lives in the proper way. Now, when I say that this has to be carefully calibrated, I mean it very sincerely, because the last thing I think we should be perceived of is making use of a difficult time in any kind of cynical way. Oh, the rabbi, wow, look how he turns it around and he's just taking it to use it to make his own agenda or to make his own point. All of these statements and all of these reconsiderations of perspective have to be done in a way that brings people along rather than allows us to be perceived as preaching to them. And that brings me to the last point. It seems to me that from the perspective of the pulpit, we have the opportunity as well to underscore our oneness with the community and our recognition that whatever it is that the community may be going through, the rabbi is going through it as well with them. We are all in this together, that his door is open and that he is available to them for the kind of consultation and for the kind of assistance that we've heard so beautifully about. Leadership within Klal Yisrael, Chazal will underscore, and the Torah itself underscores, is a leadership that has to emanate from within the people, as opposed to being an external leadership. It is the leadership of Yehuda which succeeds, and not the leadership of Yosef in the final analysis, because Yosef operates externally, Yehuda rises for leadership from within. It is the same idea that has Moshe Rabbeinu standing at the foot of Har Sinai when Matan Torah begins, HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling him to go down and to be with the people at the beginning of the statement of the Aseres HaDibros, the idea being that leadership has to emanate from a oneness with the community, and that has to be transmitted at the pulpit, from the pulpit as well. If our communities can feel that we identify with them during these difficult times, that we are there for them, that we are setting forward communal priorities and perspectives that we feel are important, that we are considering difficult issues with them, that we are facing those issues, whether it be school tuition and other areas of concern, particularly to be faced at this particular time, if they sense that we are part of this process, then I believe that all the roles that we play, whether from the pulpit or whether personally within our offices in one-on-one meetings, will be successful with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Golden. You are true to your name. That presentation was absolutely fantastic and truly worth its weight in gold. Without that perspective on affluence, the right kind. We're going to move to our question and answer part of our program. And again, at the start of which, I will certainly remind those listening in, either via the web or via the teleconference, that you can email your questions to rabbinicalumni@yu.edu, rabbinicalumni@yu.edu, with the word webcast in the subject line. We'll do our best to get to as many of those questions as possible, and where they seem to be coming in fast and furious, I will do my best to try to combine them to give all of our panelists an opportunity to address many of the issues. I think the first question that I'd like to pose to the entire panel has to deal with the issue of hope and the rabbi's role in projecting it. Each one of our panelists has spoken about, what, in one way, shape, or form, about the role of hope. Question has come up, where is the rabbi's role in projecting hope? And is it fair and realistic for us to do so? Is it advisable for us to do so? I mean, after all, if the rabbi reassures the congregant that it will get better soon and it doesn't, is he potentially hurting the congregant? And I invite the members of our panel to perhaps step in. Anyone want to start? Dr. Barris?
The idea of hope really talks about, or reflects the idea of optimism and a realistic optimism. As I said initially, I just think that helping people stay initially present with the more difficult emotions, even though people are afraid of them, many times it's through revisiting some of the shadow emotions, we begin to sort of find a deeper hope. A hope that is that you find when you push to your outer edge and you find a certain kind of courage there, what you're really truly about and what really is truly important. So that is one type of hope. Another thing that some of the studies talk about is adaptation, that we adapt to events, whether the events have emotional positive luster, like winning a lottery ticket, we adapt back to our set point. We feel good for a while and we readapt. Whether it's buying a new home or a better medical prognosis, it's very exciting and then we readapt. But we also adapt to negative events and difficult, painful events. And although employment issues are very difficult and they've been studied, when there is intention, community connection, and as Dr. Palkos is talking about, helping have a certain sense of control, we absolutely see adaptation and a sense of being okay and actually pulling through.
I have a congregant who was once my wealthiest. Currently, the economic situation has put his economic standing on, I guess how we can say, less than solid footing. As he pours more effort into his job, his wife has told me privately, asks the questioner, that she's worried that if the kids, quote, don't get into Harvard, they might be left with a tin cup in their hands collecting on the corner. I'm worried about the pressure facing the family and the kids in particular. Any advice?
And bounce off of Rabbi Golden's statement earlier and refer back to the affluenza literature. Down the road here at Columbia, there's a research team that's been comparing affluent kids from a suburban Westchester area to kids who are growing up poor, lower middle class to lower social class kids. And that's the study I was referring to before, that much to the shock of the researchers is finding higher levels of depression, anxiety, and drug and substance abuse. And that research team, in a series of studies, has come across three contributing factors to this issue, to the risk. One is that it's never enough to be just average. When's the last time somebody came to your shul and said, my kid just got a 50th percentile on SATs? That doesn't happen. Our kids are raised in this pressured environment where uniqueness is often ignored. Kids are often expected to play out their parents' dreams. And again, average doesn't cut it, especially coming off Parshas Vayechi, the Ish Asher Kvirkaso Berachosam, where we see the importance of paying attention to the unique needs of each kid. That kind of question obviously raises the wider question about the teachable moments that come out of a situation like this. The other two ingredients are also helpful and have the seeds of a solution in it. The other two ingredients are that the risks in wealthy kids seem to be from parents being at work all the time. The kids don't get nearly as much time from their parents as kids from poor neighborhoods do. And the third ingredient is the kids are often pressured to only throw themselves into academics and not to do chesed for others. And those three ingredients come together in a way that seems to heighten risk. And I think the solution, and in some ways the way of addressing this problem, building on Rabbi Golden's comments before, is to have people reconsider our basic values. To maybe use this as an opportunity to get a family like this to take stock about what really is important, what really matters. The reordering of priorities is really what a situation like this calls for, and is the potential of growth in this. Even one dialect in Chinese, the word characters for crisis is danger and opportunity. It's both. We have to hold on to the opportunity factors here, and maybe people will be more receptive to understanding that the answer is not more and more pressure on kids to get into Harvard, but the answer is more of an internal self-examination to really make sure that the kid is realizing their basic potential based on their own internal wishes, not the fantasies of parents.
Thank you. The questions are coming in fast and furious, although I have to point out most of them are coming in from different parts of this state. So if you're out of town, know that the web works just as fast from wherever you are in this country or worldwide. The next two questions, which I think touch on the same theme, one comes from West Hempstead, the other from here in Manhattan, both deal with Rabbi Golden's comments. Do we need to rethink the criteria for leadership and for honorees within our various institutions? And how can we balance Imam Kemach with readjusting values? The second question, and I believe the one that's related, asks and notes that we all agree that major adjustments are needed in terms of our values. But practically, how are we as rabbis supposed to be able to affect those drastic changes? Rabbi Golden?
I'm very proud that the first of those questions came from my hometown, West Hempstead. But I would like to address the second first and then go back to the first. I have found a startling resonance within the community at large to this issue of adjusting values and readjusting priorities. I think people are ready to hear it now, partially because of the financial crisis, but I think also because people are aware that we've sort of really gone off path on this. When I get up and I speak about reorienting the way we do bar mitzvahs or bat mitzvahs, I am surprised at the people who will come up to me afterwards, who themselves were people who I thought had been over the top on these issues, who said, you know, Rabbi, you're right, we've got to start pulling back. And the question is, how do we, as rabbis, make use of what I feel is this groundswell readiness within the community? One way, of course, is to get up and to make it an agenda from the pulpit, to actually speak about it and speak about it somewhat regularly so that people understand that it's important to us. I have found that even when we don't make immediate change, they need to hear from us what our agenda is and what we feel is important, and then the change will eventually come. Secondly, we have to consider meeting with parents, meeting with groups of parents, meeting with groups within the community and saying to them, can we reorient? Can we begin to think as a class, as a group of parents with the bar mitzvah coming up, the bat mitzvah is coming up, can we as a group begin to rethink how we're going to spend our funds when it comes to these smachot, when it comes to these priorities? There is a sense within the community that things are out of hand. We need to latch on to that and we need to direct it. Concerning the honoree question, it's something I felt very strongly about for a long time, but it's very complicated. Right now, the word honor in the lexicon of the Jewish community means something totally different than what it originally meant. Honor, when it comes to a dinner now, means who is the wealthiest person that we can find, who has the wealthiest number of friends, and can bring the greatest number of people to our dinner. That's the person we're going to honor. Honor should mean who is the person most deserving of the honor. How you balance that with the communal need to continue to raise funds is, of course, the $60 million question. We have to find a way to do it. I think we have to go back to the community. I think we have to reorient the use of this term. I think we have to say we are going to begin honoring those people who are doing the work. We're going to begin honoring those people who represent the values that we represent. And at the same time, say to the givers and to the people within the community, this cannot cause a diminution of the funds that are flowing to the community. You have a special responsibility. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu has blessed you with this, then it needs to be used properly. And if you use it properly, then you will become the honoree that's deserving of the honor and will be able to honor you as well. It's not an easy road, and the balance is not an easy balance. But I do believe that this is part of the reassessment of perspective. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Golden. The Shidduch crisis was one that has become quite well known in the Orthodox world. In fact, one popular Jewish bookstore markets a hat with the slogan, "My other hat used to be a Borsellino, but my son-in-law learns in Kollel, so I have to sell it." How they fit it on the brim, I'm not exactly sure. An old joke going around the yeshiva community right now involves a sign on the wall of one of the yeshivas, one of the popular yeshivos, with a note from the Rosh Yeshiva, "Due to the current economic crisis, we are advising our bacharim to marry for love." Any advice from the members of our panel to the young men and women who are in the age of shiduchim about what to expect in regard to marriage partners, especially during these difficult economic times? And while we're answering the question, could any of you comment, please, about any advice that you might have for parents who are worried, especially now, about this particular parsha? Thanks, Dr. Barris.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to validate that there is definitely a real loss of status. There's shame, there's secrecy, there are false promises. As it is, the shidduch crisis in that way is complicated. Perhaps this will help the pendulum swing a bit in terms of couples and young adults becoming more involved with helping themselves support each other financially and their families. I do want to say, in terms of the love piece and connection and forming the relationship, we do know that the real kernel of intimacy is embracing vulnerability. And, you know, it's not a bad first step when you're dating somebody whose father may have lost his job or whose family has now suffered a downturn, to be able to see if they can make space for that, you know, on an emotional level, in terms of using that as a piece of connection. Another very, very, very important piece of connection in relationship is friendship, and fostering deep friendship. And that's also something that we want to try to cultivate and face as we're dealing with this. So who knows, you know, perhaps some of this stuff is the silver lining that will help our couples connect in a deeper, more meaningful way, so that they can build more meaningful marriages and have a good, hopeful beginning.
I would hope that, just as we've said, that the economic crisis can be a time for reassessment of priorities on a number of levels, that we would take the lead as rabbis in trying to direct the community's attention to the shidduch issue, to the issue of people earning a living and becoming responsible, and not simply allow it to drift in a particular direction. This is an extremely complex situation. You can't go to any community and any home and not find people bemoaning the shidduch situation, whether it's in the black hat community, whether it's in the more liberal community. Everybody's talking about how bad it is, and yet nobody's really doing anything. And I'm wondering whether or not, and I throw this out to my colleagues as well, we should not, as Rabbonim, be sitting down and saying, what can we do to break some of the cycles that have not been positive, that have not been healthy here? And what can we do to try to ensure that couples are getting together for the right reasons, that the questions that are being asked are healthy, are appropriate, and that people are not just simply being thought of as commodities, but are being considered people in a very healthy sense? I think it's an area of leadership that we can exert, and I think, again, the time is right.
Thank you both. The next question comes in from Toronto. The questioner asks, to what extent does the paradigm of avilut, of mourning, and I assume the questioner is referring to Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief, including denial, etc., play a role in a pastor's response to our current financial crisis?
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of thinking about the skill set that needs to be brought to this issue. I'm reminded of a lot of what we're talking about here is related to what Shamshon Fall Hirsch and later Rabbi Schwab talks about the word nechama. But if you look through the Torah, the word nechama doesn't really mean to comfort. It means a shift in perspective, right? Ki nichamti, ki asisim, peninachem ha mishavu mitzrayim, etc., etc. It's almost always a reconsideration, looking at things through the prism that's different than before, in a way that ultimately brings to a reassessment, and then that's the source of comfort. And that's, in a way, what we're talking about. In terms of applying the science, if there is such a thing, of avelos here, I think in going a little bit beyond Kubler-Ross, keeping in mind that it's not so much about stages as it is about individual coping styles. There's some very interesting research that's come out in the last 5 years or so, based on 30 randomized clinical trials on psychotherapy for loss and bereavement. And what they find is that actually, for uncomplicated loss and bereavement, it's community support, such as what clergy has to offer, that tends to work best. Actually, it's not something that necessarily calls for professional intervention, unless it's in the situations that we're talking about where people have crossed the line into disorder, in which case you play a crucial role. But basically, what that research shows works is a combination of being there for them, helping them build up their toolbox of coping mechanisms, and basically the wisdom of what helps with avelos, which is basically the balance between what I was talking about before, naming the monster, allowing and facilitating discussion, a reassessment, while at the same time finding meaning through it, and all those other kinds of interventions. I think it's a very helpful way of thinking about this, because this is a loss, and it does very much call for the skill set that you already have.
As Dr. Palkowitz said, you know, the Kubler-Ross stages, some, in a way, have been redefined, and I just want to restate that grief is not necessarily linear, and the stages aren't necessarily linear. So you may find a congregant coming back even a year later, and it's, you might think, like, wait a minute, we thought we did anger already. We're done with that. And it's okay. Things revisit again and again, and it's okay, as Dr. Pelkowitz said, to kind of help people find the words and help them know that, yeah, this is anger, it's coming back, and we're doing anger again. So it's non-linear, and it revisits.
Okay, I'm getting technical instructions on the side as we continue. I want to just add one last comment to the comments that were made once before. When I first began my psychological training, I was already a SMEFA student and had already been in a training pulpit. And I had taken one or two pastoral psych courses and quite a bit of theoretical training in graduate school. And at one point I got stuck in a sticky situation where the standard counseling just frankly wasn't working. The theory wasn't moving according to the way I had been taught, and I brought it into my clinical supervisor, who said to me, theory is great, it helps us out and guides us a lot, but when you get into the room and you're with the person, theory stays at the door, and you have to be ready to roll with whatever goes with you based on that theory. Doesn't mean toss it out the window, it means use it and integrate it. And I think the summation of all the comments that have been made thus far really underscore that point. We've had some wonderful training in our different rabbinical years, and one of the nice things about the CJF is that they're constantly trying to expand our base of theoretical knowledge with such experts like our panelists this morning. But again, in this situation, we are our best instrument, and therefore we have to use ourselves, and looking at that situation, that Tolstoy story really, really bangs it home. The most important person is definitely the person who's in front of us. But the most important tool, if I had to add to the story, would be me. Because I'm the one in the interacting situation, and I think that applies to all of us as rabbis as well. I'm going to turn and ask a question that I really would like input. It comes from Manhattan, from the speaker, the questioner would like input, both from the mental health professionals and from the rabbis. And the question comes reads as follows. Are there clear guidelines at which time rabbis can see or state that they are in over their heads and it's more appropriate to refer out to a professional? In summation, when am I in too deep? When am I supposed to go out and find somebody else? If you're on the phone, they're switching the tape for the video webcast, and Dr. Palkowitz will begin in a moment.
Can I sing it? Tell jokes? So just to repeat the question now that the tape's been put on, the question was about probably the single most important question is how to know when to refer, how to know that it's beyond your expertise and it needs to be referred to a mental health professional. So just to review some of what Rabbi Schwartz and Doctor said, okay, wearing his various borsalinos, it was the key question to ask yourself, and this is where DSM-4 is actually helpful and is available online, is when is what's going on crossing the line into interfering with functioning? So, for example, let's talk about the most common and most ominous examples. We know, for example, that in the farm study I was talking about, depression was a key predictor of how both the adults would do and even in terms of reemployment, as well as how the children would do and how the marriage would do. When depression crosses the line from small d to capital D, is something you should review. And again, some of the examples are, is when it crosses the line into real impairment in functioning. So it's to review major depressive disorders with you. It's changes in mood, thought, and behavior that now has crossed the line into a way that the person really is no longer able to function in major areas of life. So if depressed mood is dominating more often than not, more than half the time, if thought has turned to either suicidal thought or such depressive thoughts that the person can't get unstuck from it and can't really be with their family or their friends in ways that they used to be, and a behavior has shifted in a way that even in a way sometimes it may show with vegetative signs like real serious sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, etc. All of those are signs that it's not just regular run-of-the-mill feeling sad, but it's crossed the line into a real disorder that needs consultation, probably with a psychiatrist to see whether or not medication makes sense, and certainly with a mental health professional. Anxiety, it's the same thing. Anxiety disorders, which is the other thing to be looking for, is where somebody is so crippled by the awfulizing that Dr. Barris was talking about, and by worry, and by rumination, and by their concern about what's coming next, that they are no longer what they were before, and it's now interfering with their ability to work, love, and play. And to keep asking yourself those questions, and when in doubt, just type into Google DSM-4 Diagnostic Criteria for Depression. It'll show up. And in the age of the internet, this has become a lot easier. And it's not that it could be reduced to a Chinese recipe that easily, but it's helpful. The current set of criteria are fairly research-driven and have been done in a way that's based on careful trial and error coupled with careful study.
I just want to add to that, to keep an eye on substance abuse and addictions, whether it's gambling addiction, internet addiction, those vulnerabilities sort of help promote vulnerabilities, and we see those kinds of behaviors resurfacing in a sort of intensive way, and I think that would call for professional referral.
I'd just like to address the question from the other side by underscoring that I think what Rabbi Schwartz said in terms of the most important tool is me, that we have to be honest with ourselves as rabbis and we have to know what our limitations are. We have to be realistic in terms of what we can do and what we can't do and not overstep our bounds. At the same time, sometimes the handoff to a mental health professional is not always easy and clear. There are many times where I believe someone needs to go to a professional, and yet I won't say it immediately because I believe that they won't. What they will do is stop seeing me and not see the professional. I believe there has to be a degree of trust that develops to the point where I can then say, this is something I'm not closing the door on you. I intend to continue to be involved with you. If there's something you want to bring back to me, but I believe right now we need to go to another step. I see this very often also, and this hasn't been mentioned yet, in counsel coupling, where the couple will come to me with marital issues, particularly now. Again, the stress, I think, will raise the number that will do so, where I will refer to marital counseling and again say to them, if there are religious issues you want to bring to me, sometimes, and this is very important, I'm sorry if I'm taking too long, sometimes the religious issues which they will bring to you are really a mask of much deeper issues that are just playing out on the sphere of a religious perspective. And you have to be able to back up and say to them, look, I don't think that this is an issue of religion per se. I think there are underlying things that are happening here, and that's just the way that it's playing out. But very often it's really a gut feeling on the basis of your assessment and your dealing with the person that this is just a little bit too much or a lot too much for you to handle, and you have to be honest enough with yourself to be able to make that handoff and then still be there and accessible to the person.
Since we all seem to be handling that question, I think that all of those perspectives are particularly important. I think that we find as rabbis that we actually have people for whom we can consult. That is to say, with care towards confidentiality of the particular situation at hand, we all know different professionals, be they professionals who are former teachers or professors, a confidant who happens to be an expert in a mental health field, perhaps a colleague who went ahead and got a PhD in psychology who won't charge you for the time, to notice for your situation, not that the others will, but to note that in your situation, you're overwhelmed and you're feeling over your head. As Rabbi Golden stated, we probably are in that situation. The urge at that point to flee is really also counterindicated. Rabbi Golden, your comments were extremely important when you noted that the rabbi's being there in the entire process, including possibly even making the proper referral, helps to deal and make that comfortable shift. In my other life, I treat a lot of obsessive compulsive disorder, which is another area in mental health where religion sometimes can be a very effective mask. And having rabbis in the field, like in couples counseling, like here in the dealing with the anxiety and the depressive issues, to be able to have a rabbi to whom the couple feels comfortable as they're building a relationship with somebody in the mental health profession, to be encouraging, to be helpful, to be there at the right place in the right time, often helps with those community ties that the panel has spoken about so eloquently this morning. I believe I'm running short on time. I have room for one more question. And the question was set, it comes from Potomac, Maryland, and is directed towards Rabbi Golden, at least initially. Rabbi Golden, how do you comfort somebody who has suffered steep financial loss, either through the market or through the Ponzi schemes? In addition to empathy, encouragement, and a reshifting of what is most essential in life, are there any other pointers that you have? And to the other panelists, I will add a question that comes from New Jersey, where the question was raised in that regard to dealing with the situation. Recent studies show that the blame game is a strong correlating factor in associated depression surrounding job loss. What might a rabbi do when he finds a congregant who seems to be constantly blaming himself for his current financial situation? I'll ask Rabbi Golden to begin and the doctors to continue.
Something of this is your life, seeing as Potomac was a past pulpit of mine, so if I know you, hello. I think that maybe one of the most important things that we can convey to a person who is going through these difficult times is not only a sense of empathy and not only a reorientation of priorities from on a sterile level, but a real validation of their worth as a person and a recognition that what is happening to them externally does not mean that they are less, does not mean that we as rabbis value them less, and does not mean that our community will value them less. this is why that reorientation of priority is so important on a public level, because we have to be able to say that publicly. But I think on a private level, that's probably one of the most, that not only that they're not alone, and not only that the community is going to support them, but that the community values them as people, and that the most important things are still in place. The most important issues, who they are, not what they earn and not what they do, those, the issues of who they are still in place. And if we can somehow make them understand that and make that validate that and make it valuable to them, then I think we'll go a long way in helping them. And then we should be practical in ways in which we can help them move on from there.
Just briefly on the blame game, and then I'll hand it over to Dr. Barris. There's some very interesting research on blame, and it shows the following. It shows that if you take, let's say, 100 people who were mugged, and 50 say it's 100% the mugger's fault, 100% his fault, which it is, and 50 say, it was my fault, I shouldn't have been walking down in a dark alley alone at 3 o'clock in the morning in a bad neighborhood. The ones who do better psychologically are the ones who blame themselves, which is obviously very puzzling. And what that has to do is what psychologists call behavioral blame. Behavioral self-blame, as opposed to characterological self-blame, where you say you're a bad person, tends to work better. We would never try this. You would never blame somebody. But the reason it works better is because the toughest emotion to face is shame. Losing a job is something that leads to tremendous shame. You feel vulnerable, you feel exposed, you feel like you haven't done your job, literally, in terms of being the financial support of your family. The answer is, ultimately, is anything that takes you from that shame position into a position of giving yourself control. And what I mean by that is that what the research shows is that when people are blaming themselves, ultimately, to take them from blame and guilt to a position of feeling better and doing better is to energize them in practical ways. Now, there are some research-based programs on unemployed people that talk about how to facilitate a cognitive mindset that's better. Rabbi Schwartz had pointed out to us this wonderful new issue of the American Psychological Association Monitor that came out this month on this topic, and it talks about readily available programs for unemployed people that helps them go from the passive to the active, and helps them go in a practical way, in a way that will take care of the underlying self-blame. We could make those references available. I was thinking about some materials that we could talk to you about how to make that available to you online that might be helpful in terms of that.
In line with what Dr. Pelkowitz is saying, that the APA also has self-help fact sheets that can be very educational and supportive. Sometimes, you know, people are involved with irresponsible behavior or behavior, you know, that is criminal in nature and deeply problematic. We're really involved with very complex issues right now in our economy, and all kinds of things are being uncovered. A part of this issue is that family members are going to be going to jail. You know, that is a reality that we have to deal with. I think, you know, one piece here is the idea of self-forgiveness. And self-forgiveness doesn't necessarily condone the irresponsible behavior, or it doesn't, you know, take away the accountability. But sometimes that kind of movement towards self-forgiveness or a self-compassion for our frailties, our human frailties, can be a starting point to getting the appropriate support and help.
I want to thank all of our panelists. I want to thank Dr. Palkowitz, Dr. Barris, and Rabbi Golden, both for giving of their time, but also of their expertise to us to help us weather a storm, a real storm where we as rabbis find ourselves constantly under the pressure, often underprepared. I want to give the references to the fact sheet website, which is also the website where the early articles that Dr. Palkowitz just read and mentioned, and that's at www.apa.org. I also note that many of the federations, both in New York and New Jersey, and probably throughout the country, are organizing similar such programs. The OU has a similar JobWorks program. Federations have had a number of JobWorks programs. And being a resource for your congregants in those trying times is also a critical function that a rabbi can play. I thank the, most importantly, want to thank the take the opportunity to thank YU and specifically the Center for the Jewish Future for giving us the opportunity, we the rabbis, the opportunity to sit here today and to learn with one another and to learn from three really gifted experts in the field to give us that sense of comfort from our teachers and our Abayim, and also that sense of hope and pride within ourselves that we can continue to take back to instill as hope and pride within our congregants as well. I want to take the opportunity to specifically thank Rabbi Eli Krimsky and Rabbi Levi Mostovsky from Reitz Rabbinic Alumni who helped facilitate this teleconference and webcast, and of course the technical staff who are standing behind me and behind you at the camera, who are opting for nameless names right now. Shalom Silbermans and Karen Simon, who's been taking our questions from in front of the computer. So again, a thanks to YU, to the CJF, to Reitz Rabbinic Alumni, to the technical staff, and most of all, to our gifted panelists for a very enlightening, inspiring, and insightful morning. Thank you.